Time to start thinking about winter driving and getting your vehicle ready for whatever winter throws at you. Larry Mueller here, Jim Ward with me in the studio, back once again. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, over 10 years of master certification. He's worked professionally since 1977, so he's got tons of experience. So we can talk about all kinds of issues with your automobile, and we're zero in a little bit on winter driving and answer your maintenance questions, of course. Maybe your tires, are they ready for winter roads? Do you have an emergency kit in your trunk? Let's talk about some of that with Jim. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Jim Ward, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Well, it is. And you know what? Winter is getting coming soon, maybe unfortunately for some.
So I hear. Right?
How do you get your car, or what should we do to get the car ready for winter?
Well, there are a few fronts of importance when it comes to winterizing to keep you out of trouble. We could talk about tires. Mm-hmm. Clearly, tires are one of the big factors on getting around, assuming that we're going to have some snow and wet roads. And one of the old, age-old tire evaluation tricks is the penny. The penny and the tread. And traditionally what that is that you take the penny and you stick Lincoln's head upside down into the tread, and if you can at least see part of his head, you have at least 2/32 of an inch of tread depth. And tires start out on a passenger car, or just most of the trucks you'll see around, anywhere from 9 to 12/32 of an inch. So 2 is getting right down there. That technically is the legal limit. There actually is if you go to look at major tire sites, there's a movement that they're saying that the quarter is the new penny, and here's why they say that, is if you take a quarter and put it upside down in the tread, that's Washington's head, that depth is closer to 4 or 5/32 of an inch. And the reason that tire manufacturers want you to use that, well, of course they want to sell more tires, but there is an important reason behind it, is that on a wet road, if you're traveling along at about 60, 70 miles an hour, and you have 2/32 of tread depth left, you're going to have a stopping distance that's about 200 feet longer than if you had tires that were 4 or 5. So although 2/32 is the legal wear limit in Wisconsin, if you go to your shop this time of year and they look at your tires, if they're at 4 or 5, we're just going into the winter season, they're probably going to tell you to think about, depending on the kind of driving you have to do, to think about replacing those tires. So that's, yep, the penny is the age-old easy evaluator, but consider using the quarter, because at a penny, you are really in some serious compromised traction, and particularly stopping distances on wet and snowy conditions of, and turning in winter driving would be very compromised on that little bit of tread.
Yeah, I'm in pretty good shape there. I got new tires about 4 or 5 months ago, so
pretty good. You know, most people, snow tires are something that most people probably don't need. If you live way out in the country, if you do have to do, if you have a sales job or you have a job where you have to drive from place to place over through open country, it's something you might want to consider. And, you know, ultimately, again, it just is, tread depth is really key. Just about any car that you buy that has, or tires that you buy, even all-season tires this time, you're going to have, because they're newer and they're going to have most of their tread left, are going to do fine in the wintertime.
Well, I had, just on another topic, I can remember, this is years back now, my battery going on me in the middle of the winter, which was
not convenient. And, yep, it's bad enough on any day, but yeah, batteries can be tested, and the modern testers have pretty good ability to predict the potential for the battery to make it through the next few months. Batteries are the kind of device that are greatly overpowered for most of the mild season of the year, because the cold has that effect on the battery that you may lose over half of that battery's cranking power potential due to the cold weather. So that's why batteries are rated as they are. And yep, and you definitely want to have that test on this time of year, because sometimes you get a clue as you're starting the car that it sounds like it's getting weaker, but often it's fine one day and the next day it's flat as a pancake.
That's what happened to me that time. The one thing I hate is to have a windshield wiper that isn't wiping clean. Well, that just drives me nuts.
And beyond that, it can be downright dangerous. The wipers are something you know, for most people, I consider them a twice-a-year thing. I mean, I don't know that we're all as diligent as we should be about cleaning windshields. You know, in the summertime, you know, it used to be a station attendant would come out. Most people listening probably don't even remember those days, but a station attendant come out and wash your windshield every time you went and got gas. And people may still do that, but most people don't. And so what I observe is that after a summer of scraping dry bugs on a windshield, the wipers are usually shot from that abrasiveness. And in the same way, we don't necessarily always clear the windshield great in the winter. And after a winter of scraping over a lot of ice and stuff that we didn't necessarily get cleared off, they're usually shot. So I definitely recommend going into winter thinking about getting a new set of wipers. If they're doing well, if they're not leaving any streaks, great. But yeah, for me, it's more something I put on the calendar than... because you don't want to find out halfway through that snowy drive that, isn't cutting it.
And, you know, I've got a friend who starts his car remotely in the wintertime.
Convenient.
Yeah, it's convenient. Do you need, though, he does it to get the car warmed up before he goes in it, I think. But do you really need to warm the car up before you?
With modern cars, you technically don't have to. I mean, within reason, let's say. If it's 30, 35 below or colder, any car, a modern car might make a groan, might have some odd sounds. I would probably let that car run 10, 15, 20 seconds, or maybe the time it takes you to clear the windows to go outside and clear it off. But modern cars are engineered to not really require warm-up time. For the most part, most of our winter moderate temperatures, you can start that car and take right off and drive it.
Well, lots of callers online, but still one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's turn to Julia in Black Creek first. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Larry. My question is about hybrids. I used to own a Toyota Prius, and now I drive a Toyota RAV4 hybrid, and I'd like to know from your guest if the winterization process is different for hybrids than conventional cars.
It is a little bit, Julia, but in as much as that hybrid systems have their own cooling system, uses antifreeze just like the engine, but they're really separate systems in most hybrid vehicles, that you've got the internal combustion gas engine that has its antifreeze and radiator, and then you have the transaxle and its inverter converter that has a separate antifreeze cooling system. So those tend to be serviced at the same intervals, so there might be a little bit more work on that car in terms of winterizing that antifreeze when it comes time to change it. But by and large, hybrids have much less maintenance than most traditional cars. And you know, really, the rest of the systems in the car are really the same. Wipers, tires, the 12-volt battery to make sure that it starts, really all the same concerns that you'd have with any other car.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we turn to John and Shano next. Hi, John.
Oh, how are you doing, guys?
Great. Appreciate the call.
No, I would love to call you Click and Clack, but that's a different show.
Yeah, I'm not that funny.
Anywho, yeah, I know. But say, I am driving a 1995 Ford Explorer. Replaced the front wheel bearing on one side, but I'm seeing a lot of brake rust on the back. I know what you guys are going to tell me. Buy a newer vehicle, right?
Oh, I don't know. That 95 Ford Explorer has probably got a lot of life left in it. But
oh, absolutely. I replaced the... Well, I paid a nice guy to replace the fuel tank. Anyway, but what I'm getting at is still feeling a little humming, but you guys don't really go into this on the show, correct?
Well, that's pretty much exactly what we do go into is so you had a wheel bearing replaced, and I'm betting that you had it replaced because of a humming sound, and you still have some humming sound after it was replaced. Is that?
Well, actually, I bought it used 4 years ago, and I would just sit in my driveway, but and drive a work vehicle. But now I'm driving it almost daily, and so I replaced the one. I probably replaced the other. But what I'm getting at is I'm seeing dust around the passenger side rear wheel. and on this vehicle, should I even put any more money into it?
Well, that's always a tough question. I mean, ultimately, if you turn on and buy a newer vehicle, you've got car payments, and you may or may not have car payments on this one. It's there does come a time, depending on the problem on a vehicle, to let go. I don't know that anything that we're talking about here on this Ford Explorer is necessarily the death knell of that vehicle. The dust that you're seeing on the rear wheels, it brake dust does get produced, and you may see that accumulate on the wheels. Sometimes on trucks, though, that you can have a rear axle seal that's leaking, and that may make that dust more likely. So particularly if you're seeing it on one side, you know, I'd probably have that inspected. You know, the guy that did your wheel bearing probably be able to look in there and just see, have the wheel and the brake taken apart just enough to see if there is any evidence that there's any axle fluid leaking in there. If it is just brake dust, then they just want to make sure that the brakes aren't hanging up. I mean, again, a certain amount of that is normal. But particularly if you see more than you used to see, if you see more on one side than the other, that's probably an indication that there's some kind of fluid leak that is blowing onto a little grease, axle grease or something, blowing onto that wheel, allowing the brake dust to stick there more, or the brake on that side might be hanging up a little bit, producing more dust than it should. So that can be investigated. And, you know, the humming you mentioned, too, you had a wheel bearing done. There are things, you could just replace the other bearing, but there are some diagnostic things you can do to try to determine. I mean, often tires will make a humming sound that's a lot like a bearing. And the least invasive, least expensive thing often to do is move the tires around. If you move them front to rear, if that noise moves to the rear, it probably was a tire, not a bearing. If it stays in the front, then it's a greater chance that there's a bearing. But most technicians, most mechanics will have some tools, something called a chassis ears, that they can connect little listening devices, little alligator clip listening devices to parts of the suspension, and drive it then and see where that sound seems to be coming from. And they can also check for free play on those bearings, because if the bearing's making the noise, it'll often start to develop some play. So there's a lot of people that still see 95 Ford Explorers as very viable transportation. You know, I don't see any reason not to repair it, not knowing anything else about the history of it, but those are definitely things you can keep up with.
All right, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate it. Let's go to Karen next in Kenosha. Thank you for calling.
But thank you so much, Larry and Jim, for taking my call. This is my first time calling you guys. Just had a question. I drive a 2010 Prius. And Prius 2, and I had a question on rust. I know underneath the hood, I mean, underneath the bottom of the Prius, I think there's a plastic and stuff, but do you recommend using some sprays to prevent the rust from happening this winter, or just car wash would be fine with water and stuff? And also, I go to work in the morning at 5 o'clock, so I see a lot of snow and built up on the windshield. Is there any liquid I could spray before going to bed so that it doesn't happen when I go in the morning? It's just easy to take it off, or when I start the wipers, it clears off from the windshield.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, Karan, the rust question, on a new car, most new cars, they all come with factory rust proofing. And the factory rust proofing is, particularly the last 10, 15 years, is a far better, more effective product than it used to be. We really don't see a lot of rust on modern cars. So there really aren't additional treatments that we recommend you do. You're exactly right with your thought about just keeping up with the cleaning of it. Probably particularly important is that if you do get any damage, if somebody, you know, if you catch a chip in the paint, or somebody opened the door into it and it actually chips the paint and you can see the primer or see metal underneath that, getting ahead of that, getting that cleaned up and at least touch-up paint coated over it as soon as possible is really key there. But beyond that, essentially just regular maintenance and washing it in a wax once or twice a year is enough to really protect that vehicle. In regard to the windshield, there are products that are made to treat windshields and make them more resistant to just about anything. I mean, Rain-X is a very popular product you can put on that you can just about drive down the road without your wipers. The water just sort of sloughs off as you drive along. And that making it slippery will help snow and ice be less likely to cling to the windshield, more likely to run off of it. Of course, there are plenty of actual physical products you can put on your car too. They make little covers for windshields that can go on there. But Rain-X does help Prestone also makes de-icers that are just in a spray can. So if you do find a, you know, there's not much that you can do that you're going to put on that car. If we get freezing rain overnight, that's going to keep you, then the car has to sit out, that's going to keep you from having a iced up covered car. But Prestone de-icer in a can, you can use to spray in a lock, you can use for lots of things. And I have used that before just to spray it all over that windshield. That stuff melts it pretty quick. And so the Rain-X would be the preventative. The Prestone would be something you could use after the fact. And those brands are not, I mean, there's lots of companies that make those kind of products.
And if you had freezing rain, you know, you might, one of those physical barriers that you were talking about.
Right. They make windshield covers that really, it's just really nice to just be able to grab the corners, pull it off. They're made out of nylon so that they're not absorbing any liquid. Shake them off, put them in the trunk, and away you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, guys, for your advice.
Yeah, appreciate the call. George in Milwaukee, we'll get to you in just a minute. I want to remind everybody, our guest today is Jim Ward. Jim is service manager at Smart Motors. Talking about vehicle maintenance with him, you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Michelle Good, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Net. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn talks to a UW-Milwaukee theater professor who recently won the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grant for her work with those suffering from dementia. So that'd be a great show at 2. Right now, we got a great show going on vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward of Smart Motors of Madison. He's the service manager there. And lots of callers online, so we'll go to George in Milwaukee next. And George, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Jim, a two-part question regarding new car batteries. How long should one consider the battery to be effective, especially in the case in my situation where I've got a 2.5-year-old car, but of course I left the dome light on, the battery went dead overnight, got it recharged through the dealer, and I was just wondering, should I be concerned, because this would be basically the third winter for it. And the second part of the question is, can this affect how my key fob works? Because I noticed now my key fob, I have to be close to the driver's side door to get it to work properly the first time the next day after the car sits overnight. Those are my questions.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the 12-volt battery in a car, when we talk about batteries in cars, it becomes a little more complicated than it used to be, because the car has a 12-volt battery. Your key fob has a little watch battery. And if you have a hybrid, of course, you've got a big high-voltage battery, too. The 12-volt battery, the experience you described of having the dome light being left on, and we've all had that happen. The key here is when the time of year that happens. Batteries continually get charged and discharged, and they can be discharged right down to nothing, and that really doesn't necessarily affect the battery's life, depending on weather conditions. The only reason that the liquid inside of a battery doesn't freeze in the wintertime is because it has an electrical charge in it. If that electrical charge is drawn off of it, then that liquid inside can freeze. And if that happens, that will ruin a battery. So a dead battery, well, usually when we say that, by that term, we really just mean it's discharged, just lost its charge, and this is a perfectly rechargeable battery. So if this happens in the summer, no big deal. You charge the battery back up, it really is not likely to have any effect on the overall life of that battery. One of the keys to battery life is just how much the car is driven. It's great to have a car that you don't have to drive very much. It's great if you can keep the mileage under, you know, I think they consider the average for most drivers to be 15,000 miles a year or not. But when we see batteries fail earlier than we expect, it tends to be on very low mileage cars, because you're taking it, you know, it's kind of like at a bank account. You take a certain amount out, you would do a little withdrawal every time you start the car, and you do some deposits every time you drive the car. And if you aren't making a lot of deposits, then yep, that battery just isn't going to last as long as what happens in the end. But modern batteries, for most of my career, we've considered a battery to be old at 5 to 6 years, the original equipment battery that comes in a car. Although, and for many batteries, that may still be the truth. I think if we look at a bell-shaped curve, that the majority of batteries still fail in that range. But many batteries we're seeing last 8, even 11 years out of that original battery, just never expected. So it is shifting. Battery, you know, the average is a little bit longer than it used to be. I think it's probably edging toward 7 years. So, you know, that battery, depending on the mileage you've driven, is not really likely to be failed. And in terms of your key fob, There are different things that can happen. When the 12-volt battery goes dead, you can lose some default settings that were set up that are resettable. But I think in this case, George, I think what's really going on is that the key fob battery, that little watch battery, usually good for 2 to 3 years. They are also sensitive to their surroundings, and what they're sensitive to is being by other devices like cell phones, microwaves. There are many types of devices that can cause that key fob and even potentially the computer in your car to stay awake and looking for each other. And so, it's a good idea to hang that key fob somewhere where it's not near those kind of devices. I mean, it's not like it's going to go dead overnight, but it could be the difference in getting a year and a half, 2 years, and maybe 3 or 4 years out of it. But you can take your key fob to a battery store or to a dealership. They have a little tester, and they can test the key fob and see if that battery in that's getting weak. They hold it close to it, and they move it further away. And as they move it away, they can see the signal strength on a little arrow. And I'm betting you're going to find that battery and that key fob is getting weak and something needs to be replaced. And that's probably going to work at the distance it used to after that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. And that's a little less money than the battery for the car. Yeah,
absolutely. A couple bucks. Yep.
Nick in Neillsville, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have a 2000 Chevy diesel with 90,000 miles. Runs great until winter. Then it will not start when it's cold. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I bet when you try to start it, it's got lots of starter action and cranking just fine, right?
It certainly does.
Yep. So that's rarely what the problem is on a diesel. Diesels are a special starting situation, and you essentially have an engine that is using compression and a glow plug system instead of spark plugs to start it. So you've had this a few seasons. You went through this last winter. Of course, diesels are sensitive to fuel. Diesel fuel is, regular gasoline is formulated for summer and winter mix too, but the changes in that fuel are not as dramatic as the difference between winter and summer mixed with diesel fuels. You've got to have anti-gelling additives, and so you're probably using the right fuel. I suspect that you've got something going on with the glow plugs on that vehicle, that they're not all working properly and not allowing it to ignite it. The colder the temperature, the more critical the glow plug function is to be able to get that diesel fuel to actually ignite and take off. There's a series of tests that need to be done. If the problem is consistent and consistently at cold temperatures it doesn't start, that it needs to have testing done at that point to find out if the glow plugs are getting proper power and if they are actually heating up as they should to make it possible for a diesel to start.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question about that truck?
Sure thing.
The temperature gauge only goes up to 165. So in the winter, the heat doesn't work very well.
Okay. So the heat for your inside the car.
Yes, it blows, but it doesn't blow very hot.
Okay.
Yep. And there's different things that could be going on there. The heat that you get from your heater in a vehicle comes from the antifreeze, and that's in the engine's cooling system. The thermostat controls how well that works. Now, a thermostat that's stuck open or slightly open may allow the engine to warm up some, but if it doesn't allow it to warm up enough, you're going to suffer and feel like you don't have enough heat. The second most likely cause of poor heat from your actual heater is just being low on antifreeze. It doesn't take very much, again, because it's obviously the most important aspect of the antifreeze is to cool the engine, not necessarily warm the interior when it's hot. If the antifreeze is low, the first thing that engineers have designed is that the part that goes into the heater isn't going to be going in there anymore. And so keeping the antifreeze level full and making sure the thermostat is working right are probably the keys to that poor heat output.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of diesels, we got an email from Jim saying, I store a large diesel truck over the winter. It has two batteries rather than one. Should I be attaching a battery tender to both of those batteries, or is one sufficient?
Well, those batteries, the way they're hooked up in a diesel, I don't know that most battery tenders are probably not going to give you enough juice to maintain both of those. You want to use a smart battery tender, and you sound like you already know that, something that senses charge and turns on when it's needed and is off when it's not needed. But I believe that you're going to need two of them for a two battery system. I don't believe one of them is going to maintain those batteries sufficiently for you.
There we go. Joan in Madison. Hello, Joan. Thank you for calling. Joan, are you there? I guess we maybe lost Joan. Let's go to Bill in Baraboo. Bill, hello. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I was wondering about gasoline. When I was a kid, there were, you know, a zillion commercials on TV and radio for different brands. Is there that much difference in gasoline, do you think?
There certainly can be, and what's probably more important than the differences between gasoline is the differences between fuel systems on cars and how engineers have designed them to use a specific octane of gasoline, a specific type of gasoline. We still get vehicles, everyone out there should be aware that it is perfectly possible to pull into a gas station and pump diesel into your non-diesel vehicle. There are, you know, these ideas that it won't fit, it won't work. It is also possible, every now and then you'll see a gas station that has racing fuel, something like 105, 106 octane, which also will not work in your car. So there are differences, and just if we just take regular versus premium, 87 versus 89 or 91 octane, the octane is a primary difference there. If a gas station sells fuel without ethanol, it's usually going to be their premium. Ethanol, you can think what you will about it, but modern cars are designed to burn it. They do know that that's in there. But what you should really be using in a car is what is recommended for that vehicle. Usually either in the owner's manual, a lot of times even on the gas cap, it'll say if it's supposed to be 87. If it is, you know, once upon a time with more primitive fuel systems, the conventional wisdom was that if you weren't paying more than, you know, about 5-6 cents more for the premium, that you got better performance and better mileage, and it was worth spending a little bit of extra money for premium. That is no longer true. The car is designed to run on the other octane. You are absolutely just wasting your money if you're running 89 or 91 in a car that's designed to run 87.
How about, like, brand names? Is there much difference there?
There can be. Vehicles are because of the high technology in the fuel system, they can be sensitive to different fuel types. Most manufacturers in North America, auto manufacturers, have agreed that there's a certain type of fuel mixture and a certain set of additives that are good. And ultimately, there are a number of fuel suppliers who said, yep, we agree with you that we're going to go with those. And those are called top tier. And they're, most of the major brands that you'd see out there are going to be part of that top tier, but there will be a sign. You'll be able to see it. You can see it on the trucks going down the road. And that's what I recommend people look for is any of the stations that are top tier, that's a specific trademark name that basically means that fuel is regulated to meet most North American auto manufacturers' fuel demands.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Certainly. So top tier, would you see that at a gas station?
You will. Yep. Quick Trip is one I can tell you definitely has BP. Most of the major stations you'll see, but you will see a sign out there that says they're a top tier fuel supplier.
Steve in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a question about tire tread depth and the traction and use of the tires. I have a 2005 Honda Pilot, and my fault, I didn't rotate as frequently as I should. So I had to, and the front tires wore much more than the rear, so I had to replace two tires. The new tires have 12 30-second tread, and the old existing tires that I could keep on the vehicle had 8 30 seconds. I wanted to put the new tires in front since I knew that they would wear faster, and I could kind of even them out. But the place I bought them from had a policy to put the tires with the least tread on the front. And I've called a couple places, including where I usually have the car serviced, and I've been getting conflicting information. But this place absolutely would not put the new tires on the front. Can you tell me why that is and what the best way is and what the pros and cons of
Steve.
One or the other?
And it does get confusing because the tire manufacturers and tire regulations have been fairly vague and ambiguous, and it really just in the last couple of years have some clarifications started coming out. Most tire and rubber manufacturers will say to put the new tires on the back of the car, and they do that for the concerns about the extreme worst case scenarios. If you have wheels hydroplane on a vehicle, front or rear. And if it's just one end, if it happens to be the rear and the rear lifts up, it's far more likely that you're going to lose control of that vehicle than if the front lifts up. Either way, it's not a good scenario. Either way can give you a scare if your car hydroplanes and you start to lose control. But the rear end coming around is far more likely to lead you into a roll going off the road. Is more difficult to recover from than the front end starting to slide a little bit. Usually you can just take your foot off the gas if it starts to hydroplane in the front. But by the time you realize the rear is hydroplaning, it's usually because you're realizing that you're starting to look at the side of the road instead of the front where you were thought you were heading. So ultimately, in Wisconsin, and in most cases, places we have snow, we want that better tread on the front. So that is a logical thing to do. And in the vast majority of cases, you're never going to have an incident, you know, with a concern about the rear hydroplaning. But you know, it is true that the Tire Manufacturers Association will say that the best tread, the new tire, should be put on the back of a vehicle. And again, I see people doing it both ways. And ultimately, you know, most people are going to be just fine putting the new tread on the front. But you know, I'd be very careful if we're doing this in a situation where the tread that's going to be on the back is getting down toward that minimum, you know, 4 or 30 seconds or below, because you can't have compromised handling in more extreme conditions.
And this is the case for only all-wheel drive vehicles like I have.
It's really the case for it for all vehicles. For all vehicles, that is true. Front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, all-wheel drive. You know, one of the concerns they may have talked to you about, too, different all-wheel drive systems are not as don't deal with different tread depths as easy. When those systems are locked into an all-wheel drive situation, the difference in the diameter of those tires, because they have different tread depths, is problematic on some vehicles. I can't say I've seen that on Hondas and Toyotas, but there's other makes I've worked with over the years, some of the European all-wheel drive makes that don't tolerate that well at all. And again, I don't think we've really seen problems with that in Honda, although they probably do have a recommendation that you not have tires that are further than 3/32 seconds apart.
Yeah, they did say that 8 was probably about the limit they would recommend having different tire treads.
Right.
Or a difference of 4, I should say. So, okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Steve in Green Bay next, visiting with Jim Ward today, by the way, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. And Steve, what's on your mind?
Morning, guys. I have a 2001 Saturn SL1 that we purchased new, so I know the maintenance history, and no major problems with it. 280,000 miles, and a couple of weeks ago, I was parked in a parking lot, level, not on a hill, put it into reverse. It's an automatic transmission, and there was a loud clunk, and of course, my heart sinks. I'm thinking major transmission troubles. Mm-hmm. Put it into drive, another big clunk that I hear and feel slightly in the car. Anyway, a couple of clunks and have driven it since, and it shifts perfectly. No sound, no feeling of anything abnormal. What could that have possibly have been? Like I say, now it shifts. I mean, into park, drive, reverse, and in motion on, you know, highway speeds, whatever.
Mm-hmm. No clunks.
Everything's fine.
So, Steve, when you heard those clunks, this occurred two specific times, when each time that you put it into gear that day, and that was a one time in reverse and a one time in drive, but nothing once you started to drive the car and it was moving?
Correct, and nothing since.
Well, there's a range of possibilities here. First of all, it may not have been the transmission at all. One thing that can happen, not an uncommon thing, run a car through a car wash, is that brakes can stick. Brakes can kind of flash rust pretty quickly under different circumstances. Whether you regularly use an emergency brake or you never use it at all, it's kind of always use it or never use it. If you don't usually use the emergency brake and then you put it on and haven't used it for a long time, it can stick. The pedal or lever can go back down like it's off, but it might be stuck on. And when you put the car in gear, and it may be the brake releasing that you're hearing, there aren't, you know, things in the transmission that I would at least have checked would be the fluid level. But if the fluid level was off, you could get a clunk when you shifted into gear, but I wouldn't, it's not going to heal, obviously. That would be something I'd expect you to have the condition the next day. You know, so I'm less inclined to think this actually was a transmission problem than something peripheral to it, like a brake that may have been hung up. You know, I got to say, an awful lot of time when we have this scenario described to us and we start looking around the car, well, particularly if it was hard to move the shifter, one of the common funny things we find this time of year are walnut shells. They either bounce up off the road or a rodent might have jumped up in there and thought he found a good place to hide it to find it later. But they can get on the shift linkage and make it so that we've had vehicles towed in that just wouldn't shift into gear at all. Or they had the experience where it seemed to move real hard, then it clunked real suddenly, and you might never see the walnut shell. Or you might see it sitting there alongside the shift linkage. But I know that I've had people describe what you're describing, a fair percentage of the time it's been something outside the transmission that caused some interference or interference on the driveline, like a hanging up brake. So the fact that the transmission's been working fine ever since leads me to think I transmission problems don't usually behave that way. They're not usually intermittent and come and go. So I think there was something else going on there.
All right.
Thank
you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Maybe you had a squirrel under your car there with some nuts. Joan in Madison, hi.
Oh, hello. I'm glad I got through again. My daughter has a 2012 Ford Fusion. Hello?
Yeah, hello. Go ahead.
And she hasn't had it a year. She bought it used, but it falls within a window of a defective car. She has to have her whole steering replaced, which is causing her a bundle. And she got a letter from a lawyer in Chicago stating that the Ford's falling within that window that she's in can be go through a lawyer to see if it, have you heard anything about that?
Sure, that's not an uncommon scenario. With many, many recalls with most manufacturers anymore, there'll be a law firm out there somewhere that'll start a class action suit and say, this wasn't a fair settlement. We think that something more should be done. And you know, a lot of manufacturers, depending on the situation, depending on the particular issue, find it easier to settle those claims and just pay something off than to get dragged through court and through the whole thing, whether they were right or wrong. Sometimes it's easier to just manage it by doing that kind of a payoff. And ultimately, so what they want people to do is to join that class action suit. You know, I've received one of those letters once, and since I worked for the same manufacturer, I felt like I probably shouldn't pursue this, and I didn't fill out the postcard and send it back. But oddly enough, 6 months later, I got $8 in the mail, my part of the class action suit. So I don't know that they always follow the rules and who they say responded or didn't and how they work those things. But that's not an uncommon scenario at all that, you know, and you can join it. It may go somewhere. It may not. By and large, the winners are the law firms. You know, like I said, you know, in my experience, people may get a few dollars, which is perhaps better than nothing at all, but it's the law firm that gets the big settlement if it wins.
They told her that she wouldn't have to pay anything if they won or what. She didn't have to send in anything. It was just a long letter stating that all these this Ford within this window, and she fell within that window, the 2012, and she called to make sure that they were legitimate. But she probably should go through with that, you think?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to check. You know, I don't know where she's had the car examined and where it's been looked at. I would check in with Ford, the manufacturer. You could even do it online and have the vehicle identification number ready. There are lots of programs that are not really recalls. A recall is a mandated thing that you know is related to safety on a given part of the car that the manufacturer has to fix. But they have a lot of customer support programs. They've got a lot of different little things to help customers with a certain, you know, a certain kind of a problem like that. So I would contact Ford or at least go onto their website, put the VIN number in there and find out if there isn't some kind of a program like that already that might cover it. If there isn't, then I really don't see the harm in joining a class action suit like that. I mean, you know, there are times that manufacturers have problems that aren't on a large enough scale that they're going to do a recall. And if you can get any help on the expense of fixing it, that's definitely what you want to do. But it'd probably be easier to go through the manufacturer if they already have an existing program.
But if there's and how it works is that, let's say, if there's $1 million settlement, let's say, the law firm takes its share off the top, and then the rest gets divided among the people. And that's why they they say they're not charging you for it.
And sometimes it's not all about money. They may very well get concessions from a manufacturer to say that they'll do something further for the consumers besides just the financial settlement. But again, I would just look to see that Ford, check to see whether they don't already have a support program for that specific problem.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison, Toyota dealer in Madison, been there for a long, long time. Great to have him with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us as we take a look at the maintenance of your vehicle with Jim Ward, service manager at Toyota Smart Motors of Madison. Sarah in Deerfield up next with a question. Let's go to her. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I have a question. We purchased a 2004 Lexus a few years ago, and we're putting in the high-octane fuel as it recommended. And about a year and a half later, all the fuel injectors had to be replaced. And what the mechanic said was that it was possible that the ethanol, even if it was high-octane, was damaging those. So ever since then, we've been very careful not to do high-octane with ethanol in it. We've tried to do it without. Do you think that statement is true? Do we need to be worried about that as far as the ethanol component of the gasoline causing damage?
I don't believe that's true of causing the problem of injectors in your vehicle. The ethanol, different types of fuel system use different types of plastic and rubber seals and components. So, for example, any two-cycle type device, any of your devices at home, like a chainsaw or a weed whacker or a blower or any of those kind of things, absolutely do not want to have ethanol mixed in with the two-cycle oil to make their fuel. Fuel systems, it will literally melt some of the seals and some of the plastic devices in the fuel system. Whereas on your 04 Lexus, those injectors and that fuel system are designed to be able to handle ethanol. And ethanol is still a very controversial thing. I mean, there are many people in this industry that don't like it. It does rob power a bit. You can make cases both ways. You know, there are many fuel system problems that we used to see all the time that we don't see at all anymore, like fuel line freeze up. Fuel line freeze up doesn't occur because ethanol is alcohol and it helps prevent that fuel from freezing.
Okay.
So a lot of problems that used to be very routine every winter, we don't see at all anymore. Again, there are just different issues around it, but it is not the cause of an 04 Lexus with its fuel system and its seals failing. Injectors can fail for a lot of different reasons. You know, carbon builds up on them and different things can occur. And there are many, many other things in our fuel in the way of additives. And I think this really comes back to Lexus is another one of those companies that recommends that you look at top tier fuels. Cause there are lots of things in the fuel. Something may have very well affected those injectors, but it wasn't the ethanol.
Okay. Good to know. We've just been very worried about it. I'm like, oh my God, no, we have to put that
out. Because that's not a cheap date. That's not something you want to do again.
So look for those top tier gas stations.
Absolutely. We do that all the time now. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jay in Two Rivers. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm lucky enough to have three different cars, nothing fancy, but I've got a 1999 Grand Prix that mostly sits in a garage with a battery tender, and if I get it out for about 1,500 to 2,000 miles a year, that's it. It gets warmed up each time, so I don't get anywhere close to the recommended 3,000 to 5,000 miles for oil change. Would it still be best if I change it more than once a year? I've been doing it twice a year. And my 2002 and 2012 Ford Focuses, under ideal driving conditions, I believe I can stretch that out to 5,000 to 6,000 miles, but I only put 5,000 miles on each one. But would it still be best to change them at least twice a year?
You're certainly within manufacturer recommendations. Most manufacturers are going to recommend you do it, you know, about every 6 months or 5,000 miles, depending on vehicles. A lot of newer vehicles have synthetic oil. None of these vehicles that we're talking about have synthetic oil, though. You know, and if I, in that scenario, like with the Grand Prix, you know, I changing the oil even once a year is probably sufficient. The big concern there is condensation that you get in there. You drive it, you do warm it up a bit, but then as it cools down, condensation will form. And, you know, just how much is all a little bit relative to where you live. We have relative humidity, not absolute humidity in this part of the country, so it's not as bad as if you lived on a coast. The kindest thing you can do for that is to continue to change it twice a year. You know, literally, I really think if you just change the Grand Prix even once a year, over the next 10 years, it probably really isn't going to make a difference. But, you know, I tend to, when I maintain things a little beyond what I think they need to be, I feel a little bit better about them. I'm more confident using them. I sleep better at night. So, you know,
you
I think you probably could do it once a year, but if I would probably do it twice a year.
Well, just the fact that I'll feel better about it is probably worth the small fee. So,
and that's it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. On to Natalie in Menominee next. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. Thank you. I have a 2007 Chevy Impala, and over the last few months, I've noticed that if the car is in drive and I'm at a full stop, such as at a stoplight, when I hit the accelerator, it doesn't quite go right away. It kind of gets stuck a little bit. I don't hear any specific noise. It just gets stuck, and then, you know, a few seconds later, it kind of kicks in and jumps forward. I've had one mechanic tell me that it might have something to do with the throttle. I've had a second mechanic tell me that the front motor mounts need to be replaced. So I'm really not sure what to do at this point, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions.
Sure. When this occurs, if you are in a situation in traffic where there's not somebody behind you that's going to run right into you, or the ideal situation would be to pop it into neutral and find out if the engine revs. Because there's a couple of possible things going on here. Either the throttle or something related to the fuel system is keeping the engine from either the throttle's not opening up or the fuel's not getting there, or, and this is the other area of concern, the transmission is not going into gear as it should, and low transmission fluid would cause that. But the quick, easy test is that if it's doing it, if you pop it in neutral and the engine revs up, it's not the throttle plate or the engine, because disconnected from the rest of the drivetrain as it does when you put it neutral, you've eliminated the rest of that. Most cases, when people describe what you're describing, it often turns out to be the transmission fluid is low, and you have to get the engine revved up a little bit to create enough pressure to get it to allow it to go into gear properly. But again, that's really how we start deciding which end the problem is on. Will the engine rev up under that circumstance if you just put it neutral? If the engine does not rev up and you put it in neutral, then we've got an engine problem. We need to start evaluating that and looking at that throttle body and the fuel injection system. But if the engine revs up just fine, I would have them check the transmission fluid level and see if we don't have low transmission fluid level causing a problem.
And the transmission fluid is something, like if I take it in to get an oil change and ask them to check the fluid, that's one of them that they would check, right?
Exactly right, yep.
Okay. Okay, because I know they've been doing that. So, okay, well, I appreciate it. I appreciate your tip. Thank you.
Certainly. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Linda in Chippewa Falls, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, it's Brenda, but thank you for having the show, Larry, and for Jim being there. I have a 2002 Dodge Caravan, and the passenger door is an automatic opening door. It has locked. I cannot open it manually. I cannot open it electronically. I cannot pull the knob. I cannot push the knob. It's stuck.
Hmm.
What's going on?
Well, a power, and this is a sliding door, correct?
Right.
A side sliding door. Yeah, and they are some of the more complicated devices that's on a car. Automatic transmission is a little more complicated. There are lots of possibilities there. You know, the last time that the door did work, was it working just fine, just perfectly fine, and then one day it wouldn't operate at all.
Wouldn't operate. It locked. I keep my car locked. I went to open it. Well, sometimes it would kind of do a little. It would partially open, and I had to do a little butt bump to close it, and then hit the key fob again, and then it would open. But it gets so far, but now it is totally locked up. Like I said, I can't pull the knob up. I can't push the knob in by the handle.
Sure.
I can't pull the handle out. I mean, the handle is out, but I mean, it won't pull out. it won't do nothing.
Right. So it the diagnostics for that comes down to a process of elimination. I mean, there are electronic lock actuators. There are electronic devices to protect you that go around the outer perimeter of the door that are touch sensors to keep it from closing on someone. You know, that sensor could be out of place, but it sounds to me more like we've got a lock actuator that's stuck. But essentially, some diagnostics may be able to be done by electronically taking a look at a data list and seeing a technician that had a computer that they could hook up to it and interface with the lock system. You basically command a lock to lock and unlock and see what they do. You may be able to make some diagnosis that way, but in all likelihood, someone's probably going to have to very, very carefully remove that inside door trim panel and start actually physically testing inside that door. And it, unfortunately, it gets rather involved because just the door panel on the inside to get at it and diagnose it is designed to be taken off with the door open. If you can't open the door, getting that off without damaging it is very difficult, so you may end up having some damage to that door panel, but ultimately that they're going to have to get in there to start eliminating some of the mechanical lock mechanisms from the electronic ones. But I suspect that a lock actuator is probably failed on that and is causing the problems.
Now, if the door is open, they're going to try to take the inside panel out, or they're going to take the outside panel?
They're going to have to take the inside panel off from the inside of the vehicle with the door closed. It's not designed to come off that way, but you can do it. Sometimes it's a plastic panel and it'll flex some. You know, sometimes they break and you end up having to replace some of that trim. But hopefully, if somebody takes their time and can carefully get that off, they can start running some diagnostics to narrow down what the problem is. But it's a fairly complex door with about twice as many devices as any other kind of door has in it. So that's what it's going to take.
Well, thank you. This has helped me a lot, and enjoy the beautiful day.
All right.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in Sheboygan asked if there's anything you can use to clear the film that accumulates on the inside of the windshield. Plain water just smears it around, and it is irritating.
Well, yeah, plain water is generally not the best for cleaning glass anyway. It can be from different things. You know, it often comes just from vinyl outgassing, what we call vinyl sweat. A good glass cleaner essentially is what you got to use. Water is never really going to be enough. And with automotive glass, because these things tend to that accumulate, these materials are tend to have kind of a greasy nature to them, it usually is kind of a two-step approach that you're going to take one set of cloths and use the glass cleaner and clean it really well, and then you're going to use another set of cloths and do it again, and then you're going to take another clean cloth and wipe it down to try to get all the haze knocked down off of it. But yeah, you got to find the right stuff to cut the grease.
We'll be back after the news. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance today and getting your car ready for winter as well. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. My guest, Jim Ward, back with us. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Been there for a long, long time. He's 10 years as a master certifier. Or he has 10 years of master certification, let me put it that way. He's worked since 1977 professionally with vehicles. Talking about getting your car ready for winter and your maintenance questions, we're answering them, or he's answering. I shouldn't say we. He's answering them. Join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. On to Charlie and Nina next. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a Chrysler 2014 Town and Country. It has a gas cap yellow that tells me that, and I know that it can burn flex fuel. I tried it once two winters ago, and my vehicle started quite hard, and it just didn't seem to run right. I'm tempted to try it again, but can I put that in with a half a tank already of regular gasoline? Is it going to create some problems, or should I just avoid the E85?
Well, experiments are fun sometimes, and you can experiment with that, Charlie.
Walking's not fun, though.
Yeah, no.
No, it's not. No, you can mix those fuels, but E85 definitely, even in vehicles designed to burn it, will give you a compromised performance. Starting power while driving are definitely compromised. If you look at manufacturers' recommendations for the oil change intervals, it's increased. It's usually the intervals twice as often if you burn E85. Personally, I'm not a fan of E85. Part of my reason, too, is simply because of the plethora of fuel choices out there and the confusion it causes. Although you know that your vehicle is a flex fuel vehicle, people who have multiple vehicles in the family, one that is, one that isn't, you get confusion. So for a variety of reasons, including the performance reasons, I avoid it. I would recommend avoiding it. It's not like you're going to harm the vehicle by mixing those. The fuel system has got the ability to, on a flex fuel vehicle, to adjust to the octane, to what you put in, whether it's E85 or some mixture down in between. But again, I don't find it worth it. I don't recommend it, in most cases.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. Heather in Sparta, your turn. Hi, Heather. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Yeah. I don't know if I got a problem or not, but I have a scenario. My question is, a few weeks back it was really cold, so we used the heater for the first time much, and got this terrible burning smell, like electrical burning. And I turned it off. I had kids in the car, and they turned it up really hot, and I realized, oh, maybe that was it, so I turned it down. The next day, not using the heat, it still had the electrical smell, and it's better now, but I also noticed the heat temp gauge has went up to almost the middle mark, and in the winter I have a hard time getting it up to the middle mark. It runs really cold in my car. It takes about 20 miles to get it up to two notches below the middle mark, if you understand my explanation.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, is that something I need to be checking something for? It's not a regular hot smell. It was actually, like electrical cord smell.
Okay.
Well, true electrical wiring burning and components burning is a real distinct smell, and I obviously there's no way I can know if we're talking apples and apples here on what you smelled. So let's talk about the range of possibilities. The heater typically will not have been used all summer, so it is possible, just like in the house with the furnace, that you get some dust, but that tends to produce a hot odor that I'm betting is probably milder than what I think you're describing. If you got kids in the car and you were turning it down worried that it was not healthy, that's probably not the typical, furnace got some dust in it or your car's heater got some dust in it. Another area is that most cars have a filtration system for the ventilation system anymore, using something called a cabin filter. Very popular with mice. Mice, rodents will build a little nest on there.
I have that under the dashboard, but I just had that replaced about 2 weeks prior.
Yep, and they love to come back to the same place. So I can't know that's it, but I would have that cabin filter checked. That can be a nasty odor, although it's not usually a burning odor. But you definitely want to have that pursued. I mean, it's possible that a heater blower motor, the speeds that it has don't come from the switch usually that you switch it to. They come from a resistor pack that's down by the blower, and that resistor pack can burn out and it can make a bad burning electrical odor. So it definitely bears having investigated to find out what's going on there. That I think is completely unrelated to the rate at which the vehicle warms up for you when it's cold. It's not very unusual for it to take a couple of miles of driving for an engine to heat up. I mean, until the temperature gauge gets up to the middle, where in most cars that's where it should go when it's fully warmed up, you're going to have compromised heat. But a slightly low antifreeze level can be enough to keep the heat from building up as quickly as it should. So you want to just definitely have your fluid levels checked, the antifreeze level in particular. A lazy thermostat could keep the car from warming up as quickly as it should. And those are all some things that could be measured. They can check to see if the thermostat is heating up and opening and closing as it should. And that can affect how well and how quickly you get heat in the wintertime. So that's where you want to pursue that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I sure appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Minocqua now and talk to Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a 1999 Volkswagen Golf. It's the Wolfsburg edition, so it's still the MK3 body. And the issue I'm having is with the anti-theft, the alarm system. When I'm not in the car, I close the doors and I hit the alarm. The horn honks and the red light comes on, but none of the actual locks actually lock. If I open up the passenger side door or the passenger side rear door, the alarm does not go off. If I open up the driver's side doors, the alarm will go off. Sometimes when the car is not running, if I open up one of the passenger side doors and then close it, the alarm will set itself. And it's other times I can be driving or attempting to start the car, and the alarm will engage and the horn will start to honk and everything.
Sure. Yep. I've had Volkswagens and I've had those issues. I've worked at a Volkswagen dealer for a handful of years, and that there can be different things that are causing that. But some of the issues that I've seen have had to do with the wiring, or the wiring harness for the body of the car connects to the wiring harness for the door. There's a connector. That's one kind of common area where that connector doesn't necessarily seal all the water out. We get some corrosion, and we start to get different behaviors from one side of the car to the other. Essentially, there is a fault tracing guide for that alarm system and that anti-theft system, and that's what it comes down to, is walking through it to find out where power is getting interrupted. But I, at least in my own experience, I've had exactly what you're talking about, and that's where it was, what it was related to in my own experience. But again, other components can fail independent of corroded wiring. But essentially, it comes down to pin checking component to component to find out which one is not operating the way it's supposed to, or which part of the wire harness has a open circuit interrupting it.
Yeah. Can I contact Volkswagen or somehow find out, get that schematic to see where the wiring goes so I can try and pinpoint that short?
You could try to do that. Most manufacturers charge a certain fee to the dealers and any independent repair shops that want to access their repair manuals and their electronics, but today, we live in the age of the internet, and information that was classified like that and supposedly proprietary is out there an awful lot of the time. If you pursue on a couple of Volkswagen forums, I'm going to be really surprised if you don't find people who have videos out there describing the specific problem that you're talking about and exactly how to deal with it without necessarily even having to look at a schematic. Probably more like a YouTube video to show you where to start and how to proceed.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Very cool. Mike and Racine, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I want to respond to the E85 comments. First of all, my background, I have a background in chemistry, analytical chemistry specifically. I fully understand the energy differences between E85 and regular gasoline. I also own a 2007 Tahoe, which is my second E85 vehicle that I've driven and used E85 in extensively. I totally agree that there is an energy difference in E85, which results in lower fuel mileage. However, if you can get the fuel at a price where that differential is enhanced, if you will, you can save a tremendous amount of money by running E85. Currently, I buy fuel at an outlet where, after careful measuring on both the 85 and regular gasoline, and I do know how to do both volumetric as well as using computer measurements, I get anywhere from 1.5 to 2 cents per mile better economy. That's in cents, not miles per gallon. That's taking me what the 85 is actually, what I'm actually paying for 85 at that station, and the differential between the regular gasoline price at that same station.
Yeah, all right.
It's possible to get much better economy, but you have to do the math. You have to sit down and figure out what your mileage is with E85, and you have to figure out what your mileage is with regular gasoline, and then you have to look at the fuel prices.
Yep, and as I said, experimenting can be fun, and no one has more fun with that kind of experimentation than an engineer, But I'm going to go back to what I said, but most people aren't really willing to take it to that degree, and for a plethora of reasons, including all the fuel choices out there, if you have multiple vehicles in your family, there are a number of reasons. But there are cases to be made for all kinds of alternative fuels and alternative ways of operating machines, if you do the math, you may find that it comes out for you, and if you're willing to accept the compromise and power and some of the startability issues, that's great. I mean, that's why it's out there. Yeah. You know, there are people who are going to use it. If you run fleets, that difference can make a lot of, you can make all the difference in the world, depending on what kind of business you may be running. I still don't know that, that it's quite ready for the average consumer out there and in the way that they're prepared to not calculate those things out.
Thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. I want to give Bart in Madison a chance to join in. Bart, hello.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the show. I have probably a vehicle that you're familiar with. It's a 2007 Toyota Tundra pickup truck.
Yep.
It seems to be, I get this rattling sound in the front end when I'm in, you know, low gears just starting out from stop signs or in traffic.
Okay.
It's very metallic. Not sure if that's going to be a transmission thing or a clutch.
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up on us here.
You never hear this sound when you're just sitting at the stop. You have to be moving and underway for this rattle to occur?
Correct, yeah, it's just after you start moving.
Yeah, and you know, and it's probably about 50% of the rattles with this kind of description that we investigate turn out to be related to exhaust systems, heat shields, and things that people will swear it's got to be the drivetrain, the transmission, because it occurs at shift points, for example, is one of the reasons that logically will lead someone to believe that. But, of course, those shift points are also where the exhaust gets the maximum amount of peak vibration. So can't know that that's it, but again, half the time when someone describes something like you're describing, that's what we find. Ultimately, again, it's a process of elimination. You know, we basically would try to listen to a vehicle like that. It's difficult if it's a four-wheel drive system to try to duplicate, if it's not a four-wheel drive system, I should say, to duplicate that on a lift. So it comes down to using things like chassis to connect them to different parts of the drivetrain and the steering and suspensions, knuckles and linkages, and drive it and start eliminating and checking for play once you start narrowing it down to the area that you've isolated the sound to.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Keith in West Salem. Hello, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a question for you regarding engine oils. I have currently switched all my vehicles over to cheaper lubricants. And I want to know what your opinion on this is. I had a 2002 Jeep Grand Cherokee Laredo. It was a four-wheel drive with the transmission. You could shift in and out of four-wheel drive. It wasn't a quadra-track.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it from my neighbor, and he kept detailed, I mean, meticulous record of his mileage, every gas receipt he's ever had. The best he ever got with that, and he was getting his oil changed with the house oil from a dealership right up by us, the Chrysler dealership. I switched the truck transmission and the differentials all over to Schaefer Synthetic, and I picked up 3 miles to a gallon. And some guys say there's no way you can pick up that type of mileage switching from regular oil to synthetic. What's your belief?
Well, when you go to synthetic, you're lowering friction and drive. I find it hard to believe. It does just, you know, without doing engineering, without sitting down and doing the math, that sounds like a pretty good gain. It's you know, but I do believe in the superior lubrication qualities of synthetic oils. I mean, I've done that myself when my kids started driving and were leaving home, and I never knew how many miles were going to be put on the car. I switched to a synthetic, but just so I could put them on the calendar every 6 months. You know, you could meticulously do the math and switch back to the other oil for a couple of oil change intervals. You know, I mean, do you drive different a little bit in the car because you want to see a different result? I mean, I know we do
or
that.
Or does he drive different from the other guy?
But I think he's comparing it to when he first got it, had that oil and what he was doing and the other guy's records.
Got it. And the other guy's records. And he probably actually, you know, he probably drives more mellow than I do.
Yeah. And those are kind of immeasurable, though. I mean, so exactly what you got. I mean, could you get an increase from using all synthetics that are giving you less drag throughout the whole drive system? Yes, I believe you can. I doubt that it's quite the 2 or 3 miles to the gallon. I'd like to be proven wrong, but it's that's just experimentation. You know, you can go back and forth and play with it. Usually you're not going to see that much of a gain.
Yeah. But there can be some. For sure.
Yep.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Keith. Tim in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I have a 2004 Nissan Sentra with a 5-speed. Just the base model, 1.8, nothing overly special about it. And I had an issue where when I would push the clutch in and let it idle down, when I was around an idle, my brake light and battery light would come on at the same time. Checked the whole brake system, no issues with the brake system. Found corroded battery terminals, cleaned them up. That fixed the problem until recently when it just died on me. I got a wouldn't start back up. I got a jump start. With the jump start, it ran for a while, and then it started to buck and chug again. And then I got another jump start, and the bucking and chugging went away for long enough for me to get home. It seems like it's, you know, losing power. When it originally died on me, I could have it in neutral, rev it up all I wanted to. As soon as I tried to put it in gear, it was like it was anemic.
Yeah.
Well,
that's an odd one.
You know, I would. How recently did we do that battery service?
2 weeks. It's very obviously to me related to that battery, the battery issue. It's an electrical issue of some sort. I'm just not sure if it's the alternator, which is fairly new, or the battery, which is fairly new, or corroded battery terminals, and I just didn't do a good enough job cleaning them.
Well, and you may have cleaned them all right, but here's a couple things to keep in mind. I have. When you cleaned them, you did you put any kind of a coating or anything on, a protective? There's often anti-corrosive coatings that you'd use after cleaning a battery off. Did you use something like that?
No, I just, you know, wire brush and stuff
and
back on there.
So I guess I would, you know, certainly it's the place to start is to revisit that battery, to check the connections of both the positive and the negative terminals. Don't just put a wrench on and try turning it. Put your hand on it and see if you can turn it. Sometimes it'll appear to be tightened all the way up, but the actual cable end that attaches to the battery terminal might be compromised or bent a little bit where it's really not tightening down properly. So make sure that those really are tight. You know, it very well could be related to that. Something that we often see, although this is more immediate, is if a battery is disconnected long enough, the computer that manages engines can lose some of its what's called adaptive or learned settings. So often, if we have a battery disconnect for quite a period of time and we hook it back up, the car simply won't idle because we have to kind of run it for about 10 minutes, keeping the throttle a little above idle so that it relearns those idle values. Sounds like your scenario is a little bit different than that. This has been a longer time frame than that, but I'm wondering if this battery circuit is opened again, allowing that battery to discharge, or at least allowing power to be interrupted to that computer, and you may have lost your idle learned values. But there's a broad range of things that could cause something like this. But you know, often when you have that hunch and that suspension, suspicion that I did something, now I've got another problem, I think it's related, you're probably right. That first hunch is often the case. So I would just go back, take a look at what you did, take the cables back off the battery, look at it again. I've seen, the reason I asked about whether you put a coating on it, I've seen those coatings be put on too thick and cause it to interrupt and open the circuit as well. But I certainly would take a look at those cable ends real carefully and how they're attached to the battery, how they're attached to the actual cable. It sure sounds like we might have a groundside problem, connection problem there.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe we have time for one more quick question. Sarah, have you got a quick question?
Hi. I have a 2005 Jeep Liberty. It has 100,000 miles on it. I just had the front hub replaced and the rear pads, the rear rotors, and the rear calipers. And when I went to pick the vehicle up, I drove it for about 2 miles, and the brake light came on. And so I took it back to the service department, and they put it on their diagnostic, and then they told me that it was nothing and I didn't need to worry about it. And so I'm just wondering if I need to worry about it.
Or not. All right.
You know, in most cases, when people describe the scenario that you have, it turns out that the brake fluid level was just a little bit low. The brake light, the warning light, is most often turned on by a float that's in your brake fluid reservoir. And brake fluid is very, very temperature sensitive. So this is the time of year when it isn't a fluid that's consumed, but what does happen is that as your brake linings wear down at the wheels, they get thinner. That fluid displaces where that brake lining was down at the wheel, and so the level in the reservoir gets lower. There's a point at which it gets low enough it can turn the brake light on, and that difference it could be perfectly fine on a day when it's 70 degrees out. If the next day it's 48 degrees, that can cause that fluid literally to shrink enough that that light comes on. So I'm betting they probably put a little bit of fluid in there because you don't really want to overly fill it, because later when you have your brake work done, you push that fluid back all up in the reservoir, it can overflow out of it. It's very corrosive, but I'm betting it was just low fluid. They probably topped it off. That's a very common scenario in cold weather.
Jim, thank you so much. You're coming back on January 19th. So
can't
next,
wait.
Yeah,
we'll,
next year.
We'll really be knowing it's winter then.
Jim Ward, service manager at Toyota Smart Motors in Madison. Great to have him along. And thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.